the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Yes, listeners do support this program. And my thanks to Meg Middleton of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, for generous support of the Peter B. Collins Show. Coming up shortly on this podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, we'll talk with Ray McGovern, the former Central Intelligence Agency analyst. He gave Reagan his daily presidential briefings back in the 1980s, and he has been a sharp critic of first the Bush administration and now some aspects of the Obama administration related to what we see as the need for investigations into torture, interrogation, detention, wiretapping, and other constitutional violations that occurred while George W. Bush was the President of the United States. And also later in this podcast, we're going to share a few minutes with Reverend Billy Talen. He is the Green Party candidate for mayor of New York City up against the Bloomberg machine. Mike Bloomberg is spending $300,000 every day on TV advertising to promote his candidacy. And Reverend Billy, I don't think he's on TV except when it happens accidentally. And he was in San Francisco just the last couple of days to reconnect with his base here and raise a little money for the campaign. We caught up with the candidate, and we'll share that conversation with you a little bit later on. Joining me right now are two fine journalists whose work I would like you to be aware of if you're not already. Robert Perry is a longtime investigative reporter. He worked for Newsweek, the Associated Press. He also worked for Bloomberg, but we won't hold that against him. And some 14 years ago, he started ConsortiumNews.com. Bob Perry was a regular contributor to the syndicated Peter B. Collins Show. Bob, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Good to talk with you. And also, Jason Leopold. He was, likewise, a weekly contributor to my syndicated program. He worked for the L.A. Times and also for what was the financial news service you worked for?
That was Dow Jones.
Oh, Dow Jones, those guys.
Which competed with Bloomberg.
That's right. My memory gets a little hazy there. Jason was one of the founding reporters at truthout.org. He's also published a memoir called News Junkie, which I found a fascinating read. And over a year ago, he started The Public Record, a nonprofit journalism site on the web at pubrecord.org. Jason, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be with you.
And I'd like to start by asking each of you to describe your sites for the benefit of people who may have just stumbled across the Peter B. Collins Show at iTunes, and they're trying to figure out who these guys are. Robert Perry, first, the consortium for the full name of your organization is?
Well, the website is consortiumnews.com, and basically when I was, after I'd been working at the AP and Newsweek and PBS, I reached a point in the mid-90s that it was very frustrating to try to get out important stories. We had, at that point, a lot of documents were building up. We'd obtained even highly classified material relating to some of the Reagan-Bush abuses back in that era, and I had no, it really was almost no place to put them at that point. People were into the Clinton years, and there was this frivolous quality to the news. O.J. Simpson was big. And I was actually complaining one day, and my oldest son, Sam, who just got out of college, said, well, you know, Dad, there's this thing called the Internet, you know. And so Sam actually went ahead and sort of built the website, the original website. Back then there were no templates. He just kind of put it together, burning as he went.
Mm-hmm.
And so we began to use it as a way to get out these very important stories that really changed how one would understand the recent history of this country. And we kept it going. We built on it, and we was able to bring in some very good writers who also were finding the same kind of frustrations. They had good work, but they had no real place to put it. So it became a serious website for investigative journalism, and we continued it really until back about in about 1999. We became a nonprofit. We got our tax exempt status. But we had real trouble getting financial support. So in 2000, as you mentioned, I went to Bloomberg News to sort of pay off the bills. And we kept it going on the side as sort of a part-time thing. And then in 2004, after working as an editor there at Bloomberg News as covering securities regulation, I wanted to write another book, which became Secrecy and Privilege, about the Bush family. And I left Bloomberg and tried also to get the website back full-time. And we've sort of increased the pace. We now have a number of stories each day, which is rather a hard pace to maintain with the limited money and staffing that we have. So, but I think it's achieved many of the purposes we wanted for it. It's an independent voice. It's an edited website. We try not to waste people's time with just a lot of stories. We try to pick the ones that would give people some fresh information or a different perspective on things. And we're very fortunate to have some excellent writers, including Ray McGovern, who writes for us quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
He's the former CIA officer you mentioned. And we actually have done a number of things with former CIA analysts in particular, who sort of share the frustration, I think, that some of us in journalism feel, where they were trying to tell the truth. They were trying to get the right information to the policymakers. That was their job. And they found increasingly through the 80s and on into the George W. Bush era that honest information was not welcome. So I think we've seen actually kind of an odd sort of coming together of rather disparate people, like investigative journalists and CIA analysts who are not normally close associates. But there's a common interest. And so we've tried to build on that and present a good deal of very serious but I think well-written and engaging stories for the not just the American people, but for everyone around the world.
Now, Bob, you underplayed one thing, and that is that on a regular basis, often twice a week, the byline Robert Perry appears, and you offer very thoughtful analytic pieces that often tie current events to our past history, going back sometimes 10 or 20 years. And I find those extremely valuable, and the commentaries that you've offered on my previous radio programs likewise take the story that we're focused on at a given moment and builds important context. And that's not a trivial issue. It's something that is sorely missing, clearly from broadcast media, but also it is disappearing from print media because of all the layoffs and cutbacks that have occurred over the last few years.
But one interesting thing about the Internet, and we now have an archive of 14 years of stories, and so when something happens that's topical, sometimes it's useful to go back and pull up some of those old stories and rework them into a new story. So we try to do that. I do a lot of that myself because many of those stories were things I had written way back. So, yes, we do try to provide that kind of historical context, which I think when you see things in a sweep of 30 years, they make more sense sometimes. If you simply try to look at them for what happened today and or last week, they may seem odd. But sometimes if you put them in that little bit larger sweep of history, people can say, yeah, I get that now. I understand how the Republicans evolved into what they've become, and I understand how the Democrats evolved into what they've become. And I think people then can set aside some of their perhaps short-term perceptions of these things and see that in a broader way.
Jason Leopold, your site, I think especially in its new version, and I want people to go to pubrecord.org and take a look for themselves, but you've really updated the graphics and upgraded the content with video, and it reads better than ever. And why don't you define, before I do, your focus and what you think the niche is at pubrecord.org?
Sure, and I should add that the site just went, the redesign just happened earlier this week, becoming live this week, that is.
It's great.
Well, I would say that, I started the Public Record last year for, I had some frustrations on my own in terms of what I could and could not report. Certainly, there were very few people, I would say, that would be considered, progressive writers. I don't consider myself that, but I certainly work for news organization that fell into that genre. And I wanted to report in depth on how the Democrats were actually perhaps not doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in terms of holding the Bush administration accountable. And the Public Record, the name, is really the reason I chose that name is because I wanted to focus on the Public Record. Bob spoke about the historical context of some older stories, and I find that when you take some older stories or things that may have been previously reported and hold those up to some hold that up against some new documents and information that is released, you have a pretty big picture of what's of what's taking place, and it's makes it a bit more easier to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would say that the Public Record focuses heavily on the Public Record. I really find that my expertise is digging for documents, finding those nuggets of information, and just reporting the news that way.
Mm-hmm. And are you a graduate of the Evelyn Wood School of Reading Dynamics? Because you plow through a whole lot of documents that are dumped by our government, and you do find those nuggets. Do you sleep? I mean,
yeah. Well, it's funny because I feel that it really does take a some sort of dedication to plow through them. But I, my experience during when I covered Enron and the California energy crisis, particularly looking at Securities and Exchange Commission documents, just it's unbelievable what you could find in footnotes. And that was my education in terms of, how sometimes information gets buried, but the information is really important. So in reporting on torture over the past year, I focused and used books, documents, old documents, emails that have been released by the Bush administration to try to tell, a really important story. And I have to say that, Bob has been really, really helpful in terms of helping lay out those stories. His editing on many of the stories that he has agreed to publish on his website that I've written have just, it's been outstanding in terms of how he's helped me, put together a narrative. Together, I would say that, what I really enjoy is having the opportunity to showcase those stories on Consortium and the Public Record.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still building up my website. I'm still, trying to attract a larger readership. Bob's website, Consortium News, has been around for 14 years, as he said, and I think is established as a real investigative news site. So for me, it's an opportunity to showcase these stories on a site that has credibility and certainly the readership. But in terms of the Public Record, I'm finding that there are more people coming that are contributing that are really using the Public Record. That is exactly why I chose that name, because I wanted to alert people that, hey, this information is out there. We're simply just going out and finding it and presenting it to them.
That's Jason Leopold. Also with us is Robert Perry. And respectively, they preside over these nonprofit journalism websites, jasonpubrecord.org, Bob Consortium News, and I always overpronounce that to help you spell it, consortiumnews.com. And Bob, talk a little bit about your collaboration with Jason and you know, how it works, because people do understand wire services and how stories get distributed in the corporate media. But what do you look for from Jason's reporting that you feel adds something to Consortium News?
Well, what's very impressive to me, as it is to you, Peter, is that Jason works extremely hard, and he comes up with a lot of stories, and a lot of them have really important information in them. So, as a longtime editor, as well as a person who is a reporter and a writer too, I try to help, maybe perhaps, you know, make the stories flow a little bit better. I spent a lot of time, both when I was at Newsweek, and then I learned a lot of at PBS too about the value of narrative writing. And I think my goal has always been in doing my own work on the internet and working with other reporters, is to see if you can tell a story in a way that is really easy for the reader to understand and digest. And I've tried to evolve a style of my own, and it sort of shows, I think, some of the editing too I try to do, which is to make the stories real stories, where there's some drama to them, where there's a flow of a chronological flow, perhaps. There, and I find that sort of easier for people to digest. And so I think, you know, when you have the really great work that Jason does, and I do some touch-ups to it, but the I think it helps both of us. I mean, it helps my site because I get the value of Jason's good reporting, and I hope he finds that my contributions to that are aimed at just making the stories a little easier to do. And I think it's, frankly, there's always a need. All of us have a need for us, an editor with a good eye. We all, in fact, it's one of those myths, I think, in journalism, that there are a lot of those editors out there. And we rarely, I think, actually encounter them in our careers. When you do, and I've done it a few times, I've met some people at AP or Newsweek who've been able to really help me. And so I try to do that as well with people that write for us. And in some cases, there are people like Don North, who's a really great war correspondent, kind of almost a classic war correspondent, who covered Vietnam and covered wars in Central America and Eastern Europe. And he did a lot of work for us, too. And as a person who was coming from a TV perspective, I could help him some in that I could put the stories into more of a newspaper or magazine kind of form, where he was more used to writing scripts for TV. So I think this sort of collaboration, which I think can be useful, is to have people with different skill packages who can work together, and in many of these cases, it's kind of informal. It's not like working for a company in the traditional sense. Mm-hmm. But I think the main point is to get this information to the people in as easy to read way as possible.
Yeah, Peter, if I can just add that one of the disappointments for me when I made the transition from print and wires to the internet was that what I really enjoyed having was an editor, were the editors that really helped improve your style of writing. And when I made that transition, I found it was virtually non-existent. You know, the internet being a new form, people certainly just, you know, go out there and report immediately. Working with Bob and having him, he talks about doing some touch-up. But in many ways, he just greatly improves the quality of the story. So he certainly, I think understated it to some extent. But he does a fantastic job, and that's one of the things that I've missed. And certainly, you know, having at the Public Record, you know, that's one of the areas that we're really trying to improve upon, because I think that on the internet right now, certainly some of the stories that are published by the more popular websites sort of just read as sound bites to some extent, and at least the ones that I've followed. And I like to tell a bigger, broader story and have it read as a narrative. So,
And I'd like to invite our listeners to visit both websites, and I'll just underscore that they're both nonprofit sites, and if you're in a position to help them with a financial contribution, they're tax-deductible in each case. There's information on the homepage at pubrecord.org and at Consortium News. And Consortium News has a $1,000 matching grant underway. You can get the details on the website. Now, gentlemen, next, I'd like to kind of take the passing of Walter Cronkite to talk a little bit about the state of the news business. And first to Cronkite himself and his reputation. On our preceding podcast, Norman Solomon offered some criticism. It wasn't, a sweeping denunciation of Walter Cronkite, but to try to set the record straight, he did, in fact, broadcast a very important report in 1968 regarding his impressions following a visit to Vietnam. But Solomon points out that Cronkite never really challenged the basic premise of the war, and in his earlier broadcast was very much a cheerleader for the military and for the carpet bombing of civilian populations, which he offered no commentary on. He talked about how neat it was to go up in these bombers and inflict that kind of damage. And so, Bob Perry, let me start with you. What is your sense on balance of Walter Cronkite? And in particular, was he pivotal in shifting American public opinion about the Vietnam War?
Well, I think Norman's right. There's no question that Walter Cronkite, and for that matter, most of the mainstream press of that era, of the 1960s, served as cheerleaders for the Vietnam War. There were some exceptions. People like Peter Arnett, who was working for AP in the field, David Halberstam and others. But overall, there was a general acceptance of the purposes of the Vietnam War and not much criticism of how it was being carried out. But it's also fair, one has to say, that Cronkite did grow with the story, and he became more sensitive to it. And by the time you get to the Tet Offensive in early 1968, he went to Vietnam, witnessed what was going on, and came back and offered an analysis which today would be shocking to come from any major anchorman person of that stature. And he basically said that it was clear that a stalemate was occurring, and that a negotiated settlement was the only way to go. And I would say overall, though, that there were some good elements of the news organizations from that period, and some of these have been highlighted in these retrospectives on Cronkite. For instance, approaching segregation in the South in a critical way. And focusing on other parts of these social developments as they were occurring during that time frame. So I think what we've seen, what we also saw in the coverage of things like Watergate, where Cronkite played an important role too, although he ignored it for a while, he did focus on it in one of his evening newscasts, mm-hmm. gave it a lot of time, and explained the story. And what happened with Cronkite, though, was that when he retired in 81, you were beginning to see a shift. What the right learned from the experience of the Cronkites and the Morrows and others who were some leading TV newsmen of that era was that the right felt they were too liberal. And they had, and so the right started doing two things.
One, liberal media.
Right. It became a major talking point for the right, an article of faith. And so they blamed the media for losing the Vietnam War. They blamed the media for all kinds of offenses, including there was an effort to sort of use the backlash against integration. And so you had this development, which was the right began to fund its own media, pulling together some of their foundations, and this was Bill Simon, the former Treasury Secretary, played a big role in this.
Mm-hmm.
And also funding these attack groups to go after those of us in the mainstream who were still reporting critically about some of the things happening, especially during the Reagan years. And the combination of that over time, especially since there was very little pushback from the left, the liberals acted like they were expecting another Walter Cronkite to walk through the door.
Yeah.
And that so they felt they almost bought into the myth of the liberal media themselves. So there was very little pushback from the left, very little funding for anything like a media that would do the things necessary to counter what the right was up to. And the right developed a very powerful mechanism for forcing its political views onto the rest of the country.
And Dan Rather, Cronkite's successor in that anchor chair, really was an example of that and became a victim of that.
Right. Even though Dan Rather was not exactly a profile in courage,
yep,
he was at least critical enough of some of the things they were doing that the right made him into a bête noire. And ultimately, when he was part of that package, that story that Mary Mapes put together relating to Bush's shirking of his National Guard duty, a story that was absolutely accurate.
Indeed.
There were some questions about whether they should have gone further in vetting a couple of documents they used.
Right.
Those documents were never proven to be forgeries. Still, the four producers were fired for that, and Dan Rather's career was ended. It showed again. This is during the Bush period, just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It showed how powerful that right wing attack apparatus was even then. And even at that point, there has still been no substantive pushback from the liberal progressive side of American politics to build their own media, to fight this back, or to protect the mainstream journalists who come under attack.
Very well said. Jason, your comments, and I will just explain, you're a little younger than Bob and me, and you may not have had a lot of exposure to Walter Cronkite as you were growing up.
You know, my experience with Walter Cronkite was that he was this stand-up newsman. I think that's an important term that was used to describe him. And I think that certainly I remember being in school, and there were these special programs called, I think it was You Are There, hosted by Walter Cronkite.
Yeah.
And so
mm-hmm.
he really appeared to me, certainly, as a journalist. And I've read a lot of stories and even biographies on Walter Cronkite. And certainly I think that there is there's criticism in terms of his the criticism is warranted in terms of his coverage on some issues, including the Vietnam War. However, with that said, it pales in comparison to the people that we see today, certainly the ones that were covering the Iraq War and the way that they became cheerleaders for that. I'm talking about people on CNN, MSNBC, all the 24-hour cable news programs. So while I think that there's certainly criticism that is deserving to some extent, I have a memory of him that it's a bit different from everyone else simply because of my experience and how he came across as a journalist.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, there was also a role that Cronkite played that he really kept his corporate leaders in check as long as he was in the anchor chair. Because I actually worked for the CBS radio company, that part of the broadcast empire, when it was run by the founder, William Paley. And he was a man of high standards, and he had a firewall between advertising and news and between programming and news. And that all has eroded so badly over the last 20 years. And Cronkite was really the last who had the personal power and the influence in the corporation, I think, to maintain those standards. And as he was in his final years and ultimately retiring, the company was sold and the Tisch brothers took it over. And Larry Tisch, who had made his money with tobacco, the Lorillard Tobacco Company, and real estate and some other investments, was a stranger to journalism. And it was really at that point that CBS started coasting on the reputation that Cronkite and Murrow and others had spent so many decades building.
Well, I think that's all correct. I think we had a situation where there was a seriousness of purpose about those evening news shows, a sense that there was a responsibility to the public. And one can fault aspects of how they reported things, and there certainly were failings. But overall, there was this idea that this was a public service, that they were not just trying to create a revenue stream for a corporation, In fact, the companies had took pride in the fact that these could, that in some cases these could be lost leaders. They could be things that they would lose money on, but they would help establish the reputation of the network. But what we've seen in the years since is that it's expected that these these new shows show big profits. That's changed the content. The idea is often to have soft, happy, feel-good features.
How about some more coverage of Michael Jackson?
Or things like that, some personality stuff. But even more so, this idea of these of having large segments of these evening news shows devoted to feel-good features that are better for advertising. People would rather have their ads around something where everyone's feeling nice rather than some more tough reporting about torture, for instance. So what you've seen is a tendency to neglect not just the hard stories because they're hard or the hard stories because they're politically dangerous, but also because they're not good for the advertisers. And I think that's been a substantive change in the evening news shows from when I used to watch them. I guess, Peter, you were about my age, so you used to watch them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big event to sort of get there at 6:30 and watch Walter Cronkite or David Brinkley or Howard K. Smith or the other newscasters tell you what had happened that day. And that was half an hour of rather pithy news reporting.
Yeah.
Now it's sort of like you watch the Today Show, and it's not that much different from what you might see on the evening news.
Well, I'll accept your representation there, because I stopped watching those network evening newscasts at least 10 years ago because it was back in the OJ cycle that I checked out, because they were shifting their priorities in order to pander to a perceived audience instead of giving me what I felt was the information we needed to know. Jason,
if I can just add one thing on that.
I'd like you to. Go ahead.
I think right now what these news shows, what these certainly the 6:30 news shows, what they don't do is that they don't break news anymore. I actually do remember that there was a time where some of these evening newscasts actually broke news. And now it just it does appear more as entertainment, featurey reporting, but nothing that is of real substantive value. So I think that is a major difference, and perhaps it's due to just a scaled back type of investigative reporting or just reporting in general. But it just doesn't appear that they have much to offer in terms of substance.
Yeah.
And I think that is. That's really unfortunate, because there was a time when you could actually tune into these shows and they would actually have some real breaking news on a national level.
Mm-hmm.
Due to their the type of reporting and gumshoe reporting that their correspondents were out there doing.
Well, and the audiences have shifted. You can see it from not only the news budget, the stories they choose to cover and how much time they give them, but also the advertising. The commercials on those the three network newscasts are all for people with ailments over the age of 60, and that becomes very clear. And also you can see that those network programs have ceded breaking news coverage to the cable channels, and just decided that, well, we'll focus on what will get us ratings at the lowest possible cost.
Right.
Well, gentlemen, we could talk for a long time, but I want to wrap it up here and try to extract a promise from each of you to continue to contribute to the Peter B. Collins Show. Bob?
You've got it, Peter.
Okay, thank you. And Jason?
Absolutely.
All right, gentlemen. Well, thank you very much. Jason Leopold, visit his website, The Public Record, at pubrecord.org, and Robert Perry, P-A-R-R-Y, at consortiumnews.com. And our next guest, Ray McGovern, contributes to Consortium News. I want you to go there and read some of his work as well. Thank you very much, Bob and Jason.
Thanks,
Peter.
Take care.
Joining me now on the Peter B. Collins Show, former Central Intelligence Agent. Let's try that again. I'll get agency right. That's the nice part of not being live. Take two. Joining me now on the Peter B. Collins Show, former Central Intelligence Agency analyst Ray McGovern. He's going to talk about his recent little trip to Texas.
Warm winds blowing, heat and blue sky, and a road that goes forever. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite British blues musicians.
Been thinking about it lately.
It's Chris Rea.
Been watching some TV.
Check this out.
Been looking all around me and what has come to be. Been talking to my neighbor and he agrees with me. It's all gone crazy. Well, my wife returns from taking my little girl to school. She got beads in perspiration as she tries to keep her cool. She says that mess, it don't get no better. There's gonna come a day someone's gonna get killed out there. And I turn to her and say, Texas. She says, what? I said, Texas. She says, what? They got big long roads out there.
And Texas is where W is. George W. Bush is retired now and lives in a ritzy suburb in Dallas. And Ray McGovern was heading to Texas in July, never advised in my opinion. But he went to give a talk there at the Dallas Peace Center. Ray, welcome to our program today.
Thank you, Peter B.
Always good to talk with you. And you are ever so polite to me and even to a former president who you think might be a war criminal. And before you went to Dallas, you sent a little letter to former President Bush. Tell us about that. It's up at consortiumnews.com if people want to read it for themselves. And I'm just touched by your good manners, and I'm sure Miss Manners would give you high marks for this.
Well, Peter B., I was coming into his new hometown, and I was going to be addressing what I consider to be the... the smoking gun on torture, which is his memorandum of February 7, 2002, which said, don't bother about the Geneva Conventions. We won't treat Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners as prisoners of war. That was even the Senate Armed Services Committee now in a unanimously approved study says that, quote, opened the door. Torture. So I thought that since I was going to be talking about that on that particular Thursday night, I ought to let him know that, you know, I was coming into his town and give him the opportunity to join us because we want to give people a chance to defend themselves and to explain, you know, exactly why he wrote that memorandum and what he thought would happen and what he knows now did happen.
So, and you wrote, you and Mrs. Bush are cordially invited. And then you went on to explain what you just did for us, that you'll take issue with the February 7, 2002 decision. And you go on to say about some of the other issues that you would raise. You reference your encounter with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld just a few years back that was broadcast on TV to rounds of applause from people like me. And a couple of your other efforts to contact people like Colin Powell, who used to be part of your briefing routines during the Reagan administrations, when you personally briefed the president with the PDB, the Presidential Daily Brief. And did you get any response from W about this this letter and the invitation?
Not from W, but I actually was lecturing at the library just 4 blocks from his home on the following Saturday. And it was a nice little crowd there. And before I got there to the library, well, to the lecture hall, I checked the stacks just to see, you know, if I could find any books by the Marquis de Sade, the fellow from whose name we get sadism.
Mm-hmm.
And, I want to say they were all checked out to George W. Bush, but that would be apocryphal. They weren't. They just weren't there. I don't know who checked them out. Maybe it was Rove or somebody like that. but there were no books there from the Marquis. So anyhow, we decided that when we finished this little lecture or conversation, a lot of questions and answers about this business, about how Dallasites, you know, people who live in Dallas, how they relate to this new neighbor, who, as you mentioned before, is, in my view, arguably a war criminal. And so, you know, do they meet him on the street, smile sweetly, and say, how's your mom and dad, and how's Laura, and so forth? Or is there some other appropriate reaction? And it seemed to me that Dallasites would have a special, what's the word, credibility if they were to raise the issue. Hey, you know, we're in a really tight bind here. Let's get this investigation done and over with so we can know whether there's a war criminal here or whether there's just a guy who's been unfairly criticized by people like McGovern.
Liz Cheney would say that you're trying to criminalize policy differences.
Yeah, it's not about policy differences, of course. It's about crimes.
Yeah,
and that much is pretty clear by now. So anyhow, we decided that we would go and march to George Bush's new house, and we were surprised that some of the barricades were down. They were two blocks away from his house. Usually, you can't go any closer, but we just marched right in there. One of the neighbors came by and hurled a few obscenities at us and said, well, you're wasting your time. He's not home. So when we got there, right to his curb, there was just one solitary Secret Service fellow there, and I went up to him and I said, hi, I'm Ray McGovern. What's your name? He said, I can't tell you. And I said, well, came to see the Bushes. Are they home? I can't tell you. I said, well, we're just going to do a couple things here, like read the Declaration of Independence, some of the passages that seem to apply to both Georges, George III and George the W, and we won't be very long, and we're not going to make a lot of ruckus. We would be happy to clean out some brush from his backyard if it needs it. And, he didn't laugh, Peter B. He just said, well, I've just called the Dallas police. So
you got 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. It was 15 minutes, actually.
Oh, yeah, the response time for security at the former president's house is not at the top of their agenda, huh?
Not when he's out of town, I guess. Anyhow, we did have a nice little reading and so forth, and it was really hot. So we decided of our own accord that we'd exit peacefully, and on the way out, we were met and escorted by the Dallas police. Actually, it was pretty respectful, the leader came up to me. I had donned a little jacket just to make myself more presentable. And he said, we need to do an event report here, so tell me your name. And I said, well, gosh, I'm not real particularly fond of giving you my name. Do I have to? He said, oh, no, you don't have to. I said, well, then I won't, because I don't want to get on no fly list or something. He said, oh, that's all right.
Yeah.
But I do have to do this event report, so somebody else give me the name.
And then you ask the Secret Service agent, hey, can we use your name?
Yeah. So we repaired to, actually it was kind of fun. We went to an overpass, which was just a block away, over a major interstate, I forget which one. And we had these wonderful banners that were big enough to read from underneath. So we held them up until the same cops came and said, no, you can't do that because you might cause an accident.
Yeah.
And since we didn't have Colleen Rowley along, she being the quintessential blogger from overpasses, and who knows the Minnesota law.
Right. She's the FBI whistleblower from pre-9/11 and the whole episode there with Moussaoui.
That's right. Mm-hmm. She was the one that wrote those two gutsy memoranda to the head of the FBI while she was still gainfully employed there. That takes a lot of guts.
Yeah.
Anyhow, she is now doing another gutsy thing. And she researched the Minnesota law, found out that there is no law against putting placards up on overpasses. And so she's got a real thing going with about 20 neighbors. They do that all the time. Anyhow, there was no one. We had no lawyer. We had no counsel here.
Yeah.
So we went down to the major shopping center and did our thing there until the poor people who were in orange jumpsuits were about to pass out for lack of oxygen and water, it being 103 degrees.
Right.
And then we went off to do other things. But
and, Ray, you've been kind enough to share some of those snapshots with us, and we're going to post at least one, maybe a couple of them, on the peterbcollins.com website with the information about today's podcast. So our listeners can get a sense of what you did and what the curb of W's new retirement home looks like. Now, Ray, behind the humor, and I do enjoy that part of it, I think that if we're all serious all the time, we suffer. But you have some very powerful messages here. You are bearing witness to what you see as the truth and what I think we all see as a need for justice and accountability. And you're doing this against the backdrop of the Obama administration that promised us change we can believe in. Obama has taken every step possible to cover up for Bush and even Cheney, as Cheney continues to hector him from the cable TV sidelines. And not only that, on the personal level, on a constitutional level, we're seeing Obama use signing statements, even though as a candidate he decried Bush's abuse of same. We're seeing the Obama administration, fronted by Eric Holder, the new attorney general, not only embrace the bad legal precedents used by Bush and Gonzalez and Mukasey over the years and Ashcroft before them, but also trying to extend the phony use of state secrets to prevent lawsuits and other cases that could expose embarrassing issues, not really state secrets or the kinds of methods and practices and sources that our national security apparatus might appropriately want to keep under wraps. And so I applaud you for the work that you're doing and for the way in which you are representing our point of view.
Well, Peter B., it is a little disconcerting to watch what's going on. I'm not able or willing to give up on Obama just yet, nor am I willing to give up on Holder. Holder comes out of the Bronx, as I do. And I wrote him a note just yesterday saying, look, the Bronx has been disgraced enough by Colin Powell. You have a chance to step up to history here and redeem some of the damage done by a fellow who had the best of what New York had to offer and then didn't have the courage to stand up to lies and actually regurgitated lies before the UN to start a war. You have a chance to repair that, Eric Holder, and now are you going to do it or are you not going to do it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's going to answer my question. But let me put it this way, Peter B. I think there is reason for some patience here. Everyone knows, of course, that Obama has his plate full with the economy, with health care, which I think properly is on the front burner, with a whole bunch of other issues. And I think that he's sort of put this kind of thing off the business of holding people accountable for these war crimes and so forth. He's not quite ready to tackle that yet. But what he did do, and which I applaud him for, is he faced up to the issue of these terrible, these awful, shameful memoranda under the Department of Justice letterhead.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anything like it. It makes you sick, Peter B. Four of them, some 150, 160 pages, and they are the ones that justify what kind of torture can be applied before it becomes torture. Now, when you define torture as something causing major organ failure or death, and you ask the lawyers to approve just about anything up to that point, that's what you, when you get these 160. Pages, and they are shameless. Now, four former directors of the CIA, Panetta himself, Mukasey, many others were putting all kinds of pressure on Obama. Please, whatever you do, don't release these memos. They're awful.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
And they are. Now, he stepped up to that. He released them. He did very, very little, allowed very little, extracting or what do you call it? Redacting.
Redaction. Uh-huh.
Right. And I think what he was going through his mind, and who knows, but this is my guess, is that, look, I don't know if Americans really give a hoot, okay? I really don't know if they care, and so I'm going to release these things. And I'm going to release them as terrible as they are in the hope that they'll read them or at least they'll get some adequate reportage on them. And then if they care enough, they'll build the kind of pressure underneath me to make me do it, to make me proceed with at least an investigation and probably prosecution. Now, if they don't do that, I've stuck my neck out just about as far as I want to right now. And so meanwhile, I'm going to hold these photos. I'm not going to release the photos for two reasons. Number one, I think the courts are going to release them anyway, and then the courts can bear the onus for that, and not me. And number two, I think that General Odierno and the others are quite right in saying, you know, this would really, really complicate their dealings with other Iraqi officials and so forth. And I know that to be a fact, because I know some officers who were serving over there in Iraq in 2004 when the Abu Ghraib photos came out, you know, training Iraqi officers and trying to say, we're different, you know, you don't torture people, and all these photos come out. So mm-hmm. So I think that...
Ray, let me disagree with you in a friendly way, because
sure.
I do agree that the release of those memos was significant, and that the president spent some political capital on that. But to your point about the other pressing issues, I think that one way to deal with that would be to appoint a special counsel or a special prosecutor, because that work will take 18 months, 24 months or longer, and it would take this off the front pages, and it would get people like me to relax a little bit and say, okay, they're looking into it. Here's a credible prosecutor who is examining the documents, the issues, the evidence, taking testimony. And they're going to come back to us, not with just some, you know, truthy commission report that gets buried, but with real facts, real testimony that could be used for a real process of accountability, whether it's in the federal courts or through some sort of other commission that's set up. But what we're seeing here, despite the release of those memos, is that Eric Holder has independently floated this trial balloon that, well, we'll have some prosecutions for people who went beyond the John Yoo memos. Now, I think that that is a crock. I'm not interested in seeing more Lindy Englands and Charlie Grainers dragged through courts martial. What I want to see is a real exposure of the chain of command and where those decisions were made, because I think they lead directly to Rumsfeld, to Cheney, to Addington, and to a small group of administration officials who appear poised to evade any real accountability for these actions. And while I'll give you the benefit of the doubt on the release of further photos of torture, that story is already out there. And I believe there could be a cleansing effect for Obama to say, we are going to tell you the sordid facts about what occurred, because this is part of our process of acknowledging our sins, if you want to put it in a religious context, asking for forgiveness, and trying to send a clear and compelling message that this administration is different, and that we recognize that what occurred in the past was wrong, and that we are speaking up to say we will not tolerate it going forward.
Well, Peter B., let me just say this, that I couldn't agree with you more. What I was trying to do is act as an analyst here and try to figure out why Obama has not done precisely what you're advocating here. And I've come to a conclusion, a tentative one, but a very alarming one. And you know what that is? I think he's afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's afraid of the CIA. I think he's afraid of the top military. I think he's afraid of the FBI and Homeland Security. I think he may have read that wonderful book, JFK and the Unspeakable, by James Douglas, who argues that Kennedy was done in by the sort of JCS, CIA, FBI mafia, so to speak.
Yeah.
And if you look at the situation as it is, he appointed Leon Panetta be head of the CIA, and I took great encouragement from that. And yet, what did Panetta immediately do? Number one, he kept on. He kept on all the folks who were responsible for ordering up and implementing the torture.
Well, and let me just add a postscript that, or inject this comment, that before that, he knuckled under to Kit Bond, the senator from Missouri, who
yes.
challenged him at his confirmation hearings on whether or not we had tortured. And
yeah.
and forced Panetta to eat his words that were so well founded in fact and the public record. And
yeah.
and now to fast forward to the recent weeks, we have my Senator Dianne Feinstein once again trying to pretend that she's you know, for justice and clarity while she works behind the scenes to cover things up. And so now we have this interesting episode where Panetta went to Congress and said, there was a program that I just found out about that I have killed. And from what we're able to glean from various news accounts, it was a death squad, an assassination squad program. And they're trying to tell us that it wasn't ever implemented, even though we have Bush bragging in State of the Union messages one after the other that there are thousands of al-Qaeda operatives that we never have to worry about again, to bipartisan applause, both sides of the aisle there in the joint sessions. And so what we're seeing now is that there may be an investigation by the House Intelligence Committee about whether the intelligence chiefs in the House and Senate were properly briefed, but we're not examining the underlying policy. We're not examining whether that was in compliance with American laws and the reforms that were implemented after the Church Commission in the 1980s.
Well, that's exactly why we need a commission and a special prosecutor. What I'm trying to figure out is why we don't have that yet and why Holder is so reluctant. I think Holder is not going to do anything unless he gets at least a wink from Obama. And I do hold out hope, no pun intended, that the Holder will come through here. But you're quite right in putting the focus on the congressional committees, because Feinstein, well, we talked a little bit before we went on about the Mark Klein, the ATT technician.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You probably know that he went to Feinstein.
Right.
And said, hey, look what NSA is doing here. I know because I work in it, you know, work right there. And what'd she do? Zippo, okay?
Well, she not only ignored him, she went on to try to find ways to regularize illegal behavior by, you know, making some tweaks in the FISA law that essentially would retroactively legalize the law-breaking.
That's right.
And yeah. And she's terrible on these issues, and I'm embarrassed for her work as a Californian. But in the bigger picture, we see that this now becomes about senatorial and House egos, not about the critical issues that they're supposed to be overseeing.
Yeah. Well, it's really ironic, isn't it? They're interested in complaining because they weren't informed when the crimes that have committed, you know, lie out there for addressing. I think what the lesson from this, Peter B., is that when you get the Senate leader Harry Reid standing up, who's up for re-election the next time around.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be called soft on terrorism, right? So what he does is give the action to Dianne Feinstein, who immediately appoints the quintessential fixer, and his name is Warren Rudman.
Mm-hmm.
And
former senator from New Hampshire.
That's right. Now, this guy has a record a mile long about fixing things. And I can tell you one example, but let me just say that he has been agreed upon by Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, and Dianne Feinstein to be, quote, liaison between the agency and the committee for materials necessary to be investigated. Well, this guy is poison. Warren Goodman was one of the most important people to suppress the news that 200,000 U.S. service people suffered from their tour of duty in the Persian Gulf during the first Gulf War. Most Americans think, oh, that was a glorious war. We lost less than 200 people. We lost 200,000 people who have now been approved for veterans' benefits because of ill-determined nervous disorders, which now have been pinned upon their service in the Gulf. Now, what did
and the suspicion is it's depleted uranium exposure, but we don't know for sure.
Well, it's that there is the inoculations. There was nerve gas that wafted down because we exploded it, wafted down to southern Iraq, mm-hmm. where 99,000 U.S. service people were. So it was a combination of all of you. The point is that Warren Goodman was brought on by the head of the Defense Department in the mid-90s to suppress all that. And he did so successfully for 5 years. So there's 5 years that 200,000 U.S. service people were not getting the appropriate attention or benefits because of Rudman's fixing. So here's the guy now that's going to be in charge of telling the agency or accepting what information. Well, you can't give the Senate that. You know, that would be the kiss of death. It's just really corrupt. And the other fellow, the fellow in the House, Sylvester Reyes, well, you know, he's on record as applauding this fellow Gonzalez. Gonzalez was the fellow who destroyed the tapes of the investigations.
Yeah.
Before it was revealed that he destroyed those tapes, Sylvester Reyes was praising him up and down as the Jack Bauer of the modern age. Jack Bauer being that fellow from, 24 or whatever
right.
the name of the place.
Yeah.
So, you know, he should recuse himself, and so should Dianne Feinstein, but they won't. So what has to happen? Something independent of Congress has to happen. And Holder and the president have to step up to that, and they have to step up to it soon. And the thing that gives me the most disquiet is why they don't. And
mm-hmm.
why they don't is because the mafia is still around. They're in the agency. They're in the White House. This John Brennan, the deputy national security advisor,
right.
the fellow who was disqualified from becoming head of the CIA because of offenses proven,
mm-hmm.
now he's in a key position in the White House. So,
well, and remember, Obama told us that he wanted all these divergent viewpoints in his inner circle, and I've yet to find somebody who measures up to that standard from our progressive perspective.
Yeah, there seem to be very few and far between, and not only that, they don't seem to be very bright given the decisions they're making on places like Afghanistan and the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an uphill struggle. I haven't given up yet. I think that Obama means it when he says, you've got to build a fire. Make me do it, you know? Make me do it. And what distresses me, Peter B., is, you know, I spent a week in California 4 weeks ago. I was in Dallas around environs 2 weeks ago. And you know what? When I ask these mostly progressive audiences, how many of you have read any of those four Department of Justice memoranda? Guess what? No one has. Maybe one or two hands go up.
Oh, Ray, that's unfair. Michael Jackson died.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, Peter B., that's really it. You know, I was listening to Amy Goodman this morning, and she had Obama's doctor on there. Treated Obama for more than two decades. And he was just tearing his hair out. He's saying, the problem is the fact that Americans are so ignorant. They buy this notion that, you know, if you have a single-payer insurance system, that there'll be a bureaucrat between your doctor and you. That's rubbish. What you have now with the systems that exist now, that's where you get the bureaucrats. That's where you get people that will diss you if you get sick or reduce your benefits. And so he's just saying, you know, how can it be that the American people are so ignorant? And I'll just say one more time, you've heard me say this before, that the biggest sea change that I've seen in the 45 years I've been in Washington, Peter B., is the fact that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media, and that is big. That is big. So programs like yours, you know, your new venture here, I think is really exactly what people need to get them informed.
Well, Ray, I thank you for joining us today, and I want to direct people to consortiumnews.com for all of the things that you've written, including your super polite letter to George and Laura Bush. And I want people to also read your recent post called Could Dick Cheney Go to Prison? And we talked earlier in this podcast with Robert Perry, who runs ConsortiumNews.com, and Jason Leopold from The Public Record. And I'm really pleased that you continue to speak out and write prolifically. And I'm just really glad to know you, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Peter B.
Good to talk with you. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You found The Peter B. Collins Show. Nice going. Tell your friends to sign up at iTunes or rootsupradio.com. Listeners support this program, and you can subscribe at peterbcollins.com.
And finally, on this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, I want to alert you to the man who is challenging Michael Bloomberg for the mayor's job in New York City. And keep in mind that there were term limits that prevented Rudy Giuliani from running for a third term as mayor. And after 9/11, he flirted with the idea of trying to ram through an amendment to the city charter to permit him to run for a third term because he considered himself so indispensable. Well, cooler heads prevailed, and then Mike Bloomberg spent, I believe, $65 million in his first campaign to win the job as mayor of New York City. He has he is in the process this year of completing his second term, and as Reverend Billy Talon pointed out in a talk that he gave in San Francisco this week, Bloomberg basically greased the city council to change their charter to permit him to run for a third term. And as far as I know, there's no other significant opposition. Bill Talon is the Green Party's nominee for mayor of New York City this year, and he's a fascinating character. Bill and I go back to the late 80s, early 90s in San Francisco when he was the director of the Solo Mio Festival. And the Solo Mio Festival was a series of monologues. And it was fascinating because Spalding Gray was an annual participant in Solo Mio. And through Bill Talon, I met Spalding Gray, and I don't claim to have been a close friend of his. But my broadcast encounters with him were fascinating. And Spalding Gray would drift in and out of his character. You could never quite tell, was I talking to Spalding Gray, or was I talking to the character he was currently presenting in one of his one-man shows? Spalding Gray inspired Bill Talon to develop this public persona as Reverend Billy. And that was 14 or 15 years ago. And Talon now refers to it as the Reverend Billy Project that started here in San Francisco. He moved to New York about 10 years ago. And he formed the Church of Stop Shopping. And I think it has a slightly different name now, Not Shopping Anymore or something like that. But he developed this whole routine as a phony preacher with his own Stop Shopping gospel choir. A documentary was made a couple of years ago about their cross-country trip where they hit some of the temples of consumerism, including Walmart's corporate headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, where they were ejected, and Disneyland, where the Stop Shopping Choir was parading down Main Street, and Billy and a couple of the members were detained by the Mickey Mouse security force there at Disneyland. So I consider him a fascinating character, and he has evolved over the years. Last Christmas, he was featured in a serious way on very serious coverage of an event that occurred right before Christmas at a Walmart store outside New York City, where the consumers were so amped up and lined up for an early opening for some super-duper-duper low-budget sale that a security guard was trampled to death. And it was so cool to see this satirical character being interviewed and giving serious answers on CNN, and I think he even showed up on Fox. And so now he has become this persona who is running a campaign, and I've got a little campaign card here, Rev Billy Talon for Mayor NYC, and he's making a pitch to restore the neighborhoods in New York City. He counts 500 of them, and he has a blistering indictment of Mike Bloomberg, who spends $300,000 every day on television advertising promoting his candidacy. So just before he took the stage for a fundraiser rally at the DNA Lounge, which is in the nightclub district south of Market in San Francisco, I caught up with Reverend Billy backstage with my micro-digital recorder. It's the size of a granola bar, and the quality is about as good, but you get the idea.
Yeah. It's my Elvis suit. We're backstage. stage with Reverend Billy Talent, candidate for mayor of Gotham City, the Big Apple, New York. Hey, Billy.
Hallelujah, children.
How are you?
Join me in Gracie Mansion. We're going all the way. I can hear them down on the stage down there. Are they waiting for me down there?
Yes, they are.
Hallelujah. Are they waiting for me down there?
Billy,
is this
an exercise in trickle-down economics? Are you getting Mike Bloomberg to spend as much as possible so it's going to trickle down to the New Yorkers who need it most?
No, I'm into trickle-up culture. It's just the inverse of Mike Bloomberg. He spends $300,000 a day advertising the devil tree, the demon monoculture. He supports gentrification and hyper-development, and he's sucking our souls. We need help in New York. Help me.
What's he doing to Coney Island, Billy? What's going on at Coney Island?
He wants to surround us with Atlantic City-style hotels, and they're all owned by his cronies, amen, praise be. It's just corruption. We've seen it before. We should know what it looks like by now, Peter B.
Well, Billy, I'm really glad you're in the race, and I understand that Howard Wolfson has signed up with Bloomberg, big paycheck, and his job is to sling mud balls at you and this beautiful white suit. Do you have some Teflon or other
product,
huh?
Howie, I'm ready for your mud, Howie. I'm ready for your mud. I've already been toughened. I've been out at the polar bear swim at Coney Island January 1st. Your mud, it'll just fly off my protective holy shield. I'm from the Green Party. Amen, hallelujah. I got the souls of Sequoia shooting out my third eye. Amen. Tell that to Santa Cruz. Praise be. Hallelujah.
Now, Billy, we're talking
on stage, Peter B.
Talking to people all over the
country.
What
time do I have here?
What are the laws? How can people from outside New York help you? How can they help you with your campaign?
Savitri, will you answer that question, Savitri?
Well, everybody knows someone in New York, so you can certainly tell your friends in New York to come vote for Billy. But people outside of New York can give money to our campaign at voterevbilly.org. Talk about it. Talk about what's going on in your community, too, because that helps us. The more we all talk, the better we're all going to be.
And our slogan is?
The rise of the 500 fabulous neighborhoods.
All right, Savitri, you go. You people have so much energy, and it's a time when New York really needs you.
Thanks, Peter B. We'll do our best.
All right.
That's voterevbilly.org. And then in a puff of hairspray, Billy descended to the stage and regaled those gathered with about a 40-minute sermon diatribe. And it is hard to tell where the character ends and Bill Talent, who cares about New York City and wants to turn around the consumerism that he feels is one of the greatest evils to our culture and our country. It's hard to know where one ends and the other begins. And I would just love to see Mike Bloomberg in one televised debate, one-on-one with Reverend Billy. I think it would spin his head in a way that might take him months to recover from. Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.